This is Community in Unity. The live public forum was recorded at the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage on January 19th, 2017. I'm your host, Anne Hillman. Welcome everyone to Community in Unity. This is Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue Series. Today's topic is power and privilege. Sometimes in Community in Unity, we have a panel of experts, people talking about things they know a lot about. This time, we don't have a panel. This time, you are all the experts, because the conversation is about our own personal experiences involving power and privilege within our community and how we would like to see that change, if at all. As has been discussed, the conversation will proceed with respect. And I'd like to start with reading a couple definitions that people have provided about what privilege is and what power is. And these are definitions suggested to me beforehand and then also from you all just now.
So a definition of privilege is, in our culture and society, is having white skin, and often being male, having white skin, defines a certain level of privilege. And that often people who don't have white skin are fearful in a variety of different ways, and also feel discriminated against and feel like that they have to work harder to achieve either a job or a certain place in society. Another one is privilege is denying others what you demand for yourself, the right to be human.
Thank you.
Someone wrote, respect is assumed. Another wrote, being visible, assumptions that one's opinions matter. Another person defined privilege as rights, beliefs, and advantages enjoyed by one person or group over another. The ability to have access and opportunity, stability, security, health, education, choice, and social support.
So I'd like to know from you, how do these definitions of power and privilege resonate with you? Do they seem accurate? Does it encompass what you think of as privilege?
It seems pretty spot on as far as privilege goes. There's always, usually when you hear privilege, there's always the word white in front of it. As a mixed race person myself, it's kind of something I see more the female side, more than the race side, because I am on both sides. Although the African side of me does not present as much as the white side, so I get treated a lot differently than I do in each community. That's something I've definitely noticed in my 30-some years of life, is that the treatment I get in different communities based on the color of my skin.
You said that the female side of you jumps out more. What do you mean? Can you explain that, please?
I think there's a lot of privileges that men get in the world over women. And I work in a small doctor's office, and there's two male providers. Those are our only two male influences in the office, and there's definitely a lot of, the women in the hen house, and there's a lot of jabs here and there, like in my work life all the time. And I think a lot of people recognize that, especially when they work in a female-dominated industry. It's a medical community. There's a lot of women in that, especially in the administration side. Sorry, a little shaky. It's something that I've recognized over the years. I've been doing this for, 15 years now? And been in the medical community. And there's definitely, there's things that are a woman's job, the office manager, the billing, that kind of stuff is definitely, it's kind of just perceived as the woman's job. People call in, my wife takes care of my bills. Seems like there's designated things and roles that a lot of people, they don't outright say, but in their backhanded comments and just things that they don't really notice that come out, that affect you on a level that's not really on the surface. It's kind of something that is in the back of your mind and then slowly creeps up when you're stressed out. You're like, I guess that was kind of a nig in the side.
I think one of the things that stands out is about privilege. My husband and I was actually talking about this before we came here because, he's a cisgendered white male. And in our society, there's a narrative right now that because he's a cisgendered white male, he has privilege. And in certain communities, that narrative is true. But I've also seen as his wife that he's also the subject to intersectionality. And what intersectionality is that depending on the context, you can have both privilege and oppression at the same time. And a good example of when I saw that was my husband and I are both amateur photographers. So we went to Goose Lake to go take pictures, and there's a playground there. And I'm just walking around taking pictures, and here's my, you know, cisgendered white male husband wandering around with a camera. But there were children there, and I'm a former educator, and I'm female. We know how we react when we see someone strange around our children, and all the women immediately just, like chickens, just whoop, their heads went up, and they're watching my husband, and they're taking out their cell phones, and they're looking at him and tracking him because I perceived that they felt threatened that he has a camera, he's got a beard, he's got glasses, he looks like a loner, and he's near a children's playground. And so I watched this for a few minutes, and in that moment, my husband, even though in most communities he may have privilege, he did not have privilege until I, his wife, who, depending on context, I am of multi-ethnic heritage, I identify as Black, my mother is Black. You know, here comes his short Black wife and comes over and starts talking to him, you know, and I purposely talked loudly, you know, hey, baby, you know that this is someone I'm in a relationship with. And immediately the women relaxed because now this man had been vouched for. He's not a stray, weird male who may be a harm to our children. He belongs to a woman, and a man and a woman, well, if they're husband and wife, they can't both be creepos. And immediately the women just tuned him out, just tuned him out. He went immediately back into the background. With the other males who were there with their girlfriends or their children or what have you, they immediately decided he was not a threat.
So privilege is flexible, yes, depending on context.
Very much.
Would others agree with that? Yeah. I heard a lot of yeses and one no.
I mean, that was a really wonderful contextual example of things shifting. But I think overall, as a society, in this American society, that there's still a very overriding white skin privilege and male privilege. I mean, we have not achieved equity of equal pay for the same job between men and women. And, well, I don't want to get into a whole political conversation either. So I'm going to stop there.
I'm just reading the board over again, and I think one of the biggest ones that stands out for me from privilege is the access to resources. And I think it's something that maybe those who are privileged don't even realize that it's something that they have available to them. And it's something that, I mean, even when I'm a sociology major, and even when I went to university and was studying these things, I was like shocked that I hadn't heard about this until I was 18, 19 years old. And I think that just speaks a lot to the privilege that I was experiencing. And yeah, I mean, I just remember feeling completely torn about it and heartbroken that I can't believe I never even recognized this before until 18 years into my life, and didn't even, like, I still don't even fully understand it because of the privilege that I do have. So I think that speaks most to me after reading the board.
To build on what you said, as a fellow academic, I can understand that because it also, it's possibly cultural. I'm multi-ethnic. You know, my father was German, English, Irish, and Austrian Jew. My mother is African-American, Cuban-American, and Native American, you know, shot a gringo in there because, well, things happened when we got bought over here, my ancestors. But race and gender are commonly talked about in minority circles. We're taught to be very aware of it. And actually, in many ways, as I've studied sociology in conjunction with my rhetoric, I have found that we are pretty much trained to already see the world through an intersectional lens, to see where there's these different areas and circles of race and privilege and moments of oppression and power. But, you know, when I go over to, you know, my European American side of the family, you know, that's not really talked about, you know, because, you know, either A, there's the perception that if they're conservative, that's a liberal subject, you know, liberals. And then, you know, even my very liberal European American family members, you know, they feel race has been very well discussed and we're very well aware of it. And, you know, we go to college and we learn about these things. We have all these higher ideas and so forth. And yet what I find is that neither of them have true boots on the ground practical application of either concept. So they're actually in a bubble thinking they're not in a bubble. And then you come along and poke that. Well, now you're poking my identity and my perception, my worldview. So, whoa, back off there, you whippersnapper. You don't know as much as you think you do. And so then it becomes ageism. Well, I'm older than you. I have more life experience. You know, you got fancy book learning. And I'm like, but I live this. And I've been trained all my life to navigate it by both my parents, because my father, even though he was a cisgendered, perceived to be white male, he was a Jew. And he experienced a lot of anti-Semitism in his life for that. My mother was a black woman, darker skinned than I am, but she experienced a policing of her black body. She worked as a part-time model, and she was told to have a more marketable appearance. And what the marketable appearance was, a ski slope nose.
Kind of going off of that, I think it just speaks to the idea that it's a privilege to not have to think about privilege. As in my own personal experience, I identify as a white cisgender male, and that's allowed me to navigate and avoid a lot of conversations about privilege, even though I do have aspects of myself, such as my sexuality, that do put me at a less privileged location. These other aspects of my life allow me to navigate these circles where I don't have to think about privilege and how things are just assumed for me. Like, it was accepted that I would go to college. And these were just things that I did not have to think about until I took the time to sort of hear other narratives other than my own and sort of to see that there were, how much I had been taken for granted, how much I had taken for granted.
And for people who don't know, cisgender is people who identify with a gender at birth. I suppose if you were putting in a dichotomous language, you would say cisgender versus transgender. It's a term that's in common usage these days, but it certainly hasn't always been. What are other examples of times that you've become aware of the privilege that you have or that others lack?
So I identify as a cisgender female, and I am white. And when I was still in high school, circumstances just came to be where I had to move out of my parents' home. And just a lot of assumptions that had been made of me with my middle class background of what my future was going to look like were just totally taken away. And after, like, looking back, it's like why I can see how I was so afraid of what was assumed for me in my future. I had no idea that my future could look anything like not going to college. I didn't even know what that would look like because of what was assumed and provided to me because of my economic and racial privilege.
How did you adapt when you realized that you no longer had the privileges that you thought you had?
Despite not having the financial capital, I still had social capital available to me because of class and race. So I was able to get by, but I almost am ashamed of that fear I had of what I thought was just going to be offered to me, seeing that potentially not in my future was what really brought fear to me. And that's privilege in and of itself, that what was going to just be laid out for me would maybe be taken away.
I haven't experienced problems because I'm white, even though I'm Jewish. But I don't have day-to-day interactions where I've encountered problems regarding privilege, but I have been with other people who have, and it always takes me aback. And one instance that I think of all the time when we have these conversations is a woman I worked with in Oregon who was an investigator who had much more money than I had. She owned a car that was a Mercedes. She had her own house. I was struggling as an attorney working as a public defender. And she was black, I'm white, and we went shopping one day. And I realized that someone in the store was following us. And I turned around and said, "Are you following us?" And I was just kind of stunned. And this guy kind of pulled back. I said, "No, no, come here. Are you following us?" And he said, "Well, I'm following her." And I said, "Because why?" And he just stared at me. And I said, "Really, if you want to follow someone who might be a potential for needing to steal something, you should be following me, not her." And she just kind of rolled her eyes at,
at the situation because she was used to it. I had never been around anyone where that had happened before. So I had heard about it. My friends in law school would talk about, you know, who were black, would talk about fear of the police, fear of being, you know, threatened, etc. But I had never actually seen it happen. And it was it really took me aback that people had to live with that, and because I didn't have to live with it.
How did that change how you interacted, I guess, with the, like, how did that change you, having that personal experience of seeing your own privilege in action?
I think I've always been very aware of my privilege, so I'm not sure that it did change it. And I've always been very vocal about inequity and disparity. So I'm not sure that it changed it. It just cemented. It was a memory that cemented in me an awareness that maybe I didn't have, a deeper awareness as more of a, it wasn't something that I had heard about any longer. It was something that I had witnessed and been a part of.
Do others have similar experiences of becoming aware of your own privilege versus others?
So before I mention that, I just counted in the room, and if privilege consists of not having to question, it's interesting to note that there are nearly four times as many women here tonight to explore this subject as there are men. And, you know, I'm grateful for the men, and there are many men who are concerned about inequities between men and women in general. But it's just interesting that women are much more attuned, it seems to me, with the to those inequities. Some years ago, I was born and raised here in Anchorage, and I wasn't really aware of a black community. Although now I look at my high school yearbooks and I see there were more African Americans than I had recognized at the time. But several years ago, I became involved with a man who was my peer at work and a very interesting guy, and he just happened to be African American. And through him, I was absolutely stunned because we'd be driving down a road and he would say, "I have to be careful, especially on this road and this road and this road." And I'm going, you know, you are a decent, law-abiding, well-educated professional. And it just blew me away. I didn't have to worry about where I drove when. And, you know, if he drove between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., he was for sure going to get pulled over. And if he drove on certain roads, he was for sure going to get pulled over, although he'd done nothing at all. That was a real moment or period of awareness for me. And now when I hear about African-American moms telling their sons, do this, don't do that, it makes me weep that they have to pay attention in a way that I don't.
For those of us who experience some level of privilege, is it easy or hard for you to acknowledge that?
I think it definitely is at first. That's sort of the whole point of having privilege, is that you assume people see the world through the same lens that you see it, because you don't have to be aware that there are other lenses out there. So for the most part, most people don't go about their day thinking, "I'm a racist" or "I'm sexist." And that can be a really uncomfortable thing to realize about yourself. I know I grew up in a very small town that had a overwhelmingly white population, and I, you know, have to look back and do some reconciliation about the fact that, you know, I wasn't aware or educated as to the privilege that I had. And when I first started going out and discovering that inequity, it really did poke that sense of who I was and what I stood for. And, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not this, I'm not that, I love everyone equally, I have these types of friends. And then to see these articles or to see these comments that really made me question who I was a very, I mean, life-altering experience in a great way, because I feel much better with the education I have and that I'm striving for now. But it's just sort of a, I don't know,
it's a funny thing to admit in a room full of strangers, that initial feeling of realizing, oh my gosh, I am not as aware as I should be. And I'm so glad that I had that experience, but it's extremely uncomfortable. And it does make me aware when I'm trying to explain to somebody, you know, my male friends, what it's like to be a female, trying to put it into a context where they can understand it. Having felt that uncomfortable sensation firsthand, I understand that it's really difficult to sometimes get people to understand. I'm not attacking you, I'm just asking you to understand this privilege. So it's interesting.
So what would you all say are ways that we can help people understand their privilege?
I think we need to update our terms. The thing we need to focus on when we're addressing, you know, issues of power and privilege is that we need to use more correct terms that reflect the society we're living in the 21st century. You know, we don't have, pun not intended, black and white racism anymore. We don't have black and white sexism anymore. We don't have black and white homophobia anymore. Instead, the situation, because we're in a pluralistic society, is curiarchy. And what curiarchy is multiple systems of oppression that can be operating at the same time, depending on the sociocultural or economic context. Like, if you go to Mat-Su, I grew up in Mat-Su, and I grew up in an area that was a dying farm community. Methamphetamine abuse, drug abuse, got rich people on one side of the lake, shanties on the other side of the lake. It's very stark divide. It's a little, I can understand, you know, why a populist rhetoric from our current person in power would resonate with the people who have been stripped of their identity. They have no identity left. You're living out in the Butte, you're seeing farms die and shut down, your way of life is disappearing, your jobs are disappearing, methamphetamine abuse is rampant, you don't know anybody who's not hooked on the ice, you know, your kids are getting involved in, you know, I mean, even my pastor has commented that if you're from Mat-Su, there's a good chance you're going to end up in Highland or one of the other correctional facilities here in Anchorage and Mat-Su. And he's seen this after being 30 years as a pastor up here in Alaska. And a populist rhetoric resonates with people like that when, what privilege? How am I, a white person in the Butte, privileged when I have nothing and I'm living in a shanty? Where's my privilege? You know, and that's why, you know, it's hard to see to another person how you'd have it better than me because you're not in a shanty, you know? That's why it's hard for them growing up in that community. I understand the mindset, having grown up and seen and interacted with the people in that area, of why, you know, when I hear a African-American person complaining, a woman complaining, some other person complaining about their lack of privilege, they don't perceive it that way because they're like, you have a job, you have a car, you have a future, you have stability, you have opportunity, and I don't have these things. So how are you not privileged? And that's what we're up against. And so the only way to recognize and combat that is we have to start teaching it as a form of curiarchy. Because, you know, touching on an example of my husband earlier, white people are profiled too. My aunt's a former FBI agent. When they're looking for a serial killer, they don't think a black dude. They start looking for a middle-aged white man. When they start looking for a child molester, they don't think, you know, a Latino-American dude. They start thinking a white guy in his middle-aged, probably a loner. He may even have a wife. That's what they look for. There's different systems operating at the same time.
But so then I have a question, because you just profiled people who live out in the Butte as being broke, living in shacks, addicted to meth. I mean, don't we all, to a certain degree, just put people into categories based on where they're from or what they do? I mean, people make tons of assumptions about me because I'm married to a woman, you know, that aren't necessarily true. So, like,
try to judge on the content of character. I'm speaking in averages. I realize this. I'm painting with a broad, broad brush here, and I understand that I'm painting with a broad, broad brush because my family lives out in the Mat-Su area, in the Butte, Palmer, and Wasilla areas, and as much as there's examples of ne'er-do-wells in that community, they're not representative of the whole community. There's good, solid people out there that care, but there are issues in that community that are systemic and that can lead people to where a populist rhetoric will resonate with them. And so I'm not saying all of the people in the Mat-Su are bad or terrible or awful. I'm saying there's a contingent out there that aren't being heard, and we have ways that we tune each other out.
You know, one of the things which I've always tried to figure out why people do what they do, that to me is even a little bit more interesting than what they do. And one of the things in terms of how we want to compare ourselves to others, I think that strikes at the core of our tribalism. We want to be associated with people that we know. And you, it's like you you scratch somebody and it's even happened to me and suddenly I'm a two-year-old in a sandbox. You know, I just go back there and we all, as humans, become tribal. One of the things I think that would be helpful is if we looked several generations back, some of the folks that came up in Mat-Su, since you mentioned Mat-Su, they came up on federal money. They got the land set there. I mean, it was a question of they had to prove up on it. And what they were, what the federal government was trying to do was to move people from land that they'd starve on to a place that didn't have people, Alaska, and they set up the farming system. My dad, who worked through the Civilian Conservation Corps back during the Depression, they didn't have black men involved in the CCCs, just whites. So what kind of a disadvantage did that do? I also know that after World War II, only 5% of the federal money going to veterans for housing went to blacks. Now, for most of us, the most valuable thing we'll ever own is a home. So by a very stark, direct attitude of, well, this man's fighting and dying wasn't worth as much as this person's. I mean, I think it was just part of the absolute attitude. One of the things I got out of the South as fast as I could, and I was born in 44, so I saw a lot of bad stuff. I became aware when I was about 6 and looked around and watched what people did. But when I got to Fairbanks in 1967 for 1 year, and then back in 70, I loved it. There were no isms in Fairbanks. January of 68, it was minus 55 and colder for 2 weeks. And there were no telephones in your cars. So nobody had a prejudice, because at 40 below, if your car broke down before anybody could get to you, you would be a popsicle. So it's that underlayment of knowledge of we are dependent upon each other that made a heck of a difference. That was something which really made a huge difference in how I saw how people could live together. And that was the cold in Fairbanks.
You started with this conversation about how history has led to the situation we're in right now and the hierarchies that exist right now. Are there other examples of ways you can think of how history has built these hierarchies? I know that some folks mentioned things like redlining up on the board.
I completely agree. And the history of power and privilege is something that I've been thinking about a lot these past few months, these past few years, because there is, at least for myself, that tendency to think in the moment and to understand what is happening in this time and place. But in reality, what is happening now is a reflection of not just generations, but centuries of disempowerment and privilege. White privilege has existed for far longer than my ancestors have been in the United States. The migrationist Isabel Wilkerson, who may have read a book that's been around recently called The Warmth of Other Suns, did a really incredible interview with Krista Tippett for the program On Being. And she's talking about the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North. And she's putting it in the context of what is happening today. And she calls on listeners for what she terms radical empathy. And radical empathy not being sympathy, kind of, looking across at someone, but understanding why is someone doing what they are doing from the perspective of what they have endured and the perspective of what their ancestors have endured. And I think that placing radical empathy in that model of historicism is really powerful.
Do people think that's something we should think about trying to build, radical empathy? And if so, how? I hear chuckles somewhere.
Back when you asked about how we made people aware of their privilege or what to do with that. I think this connects into that, that for me, I think understanding other people's struggles and maybe having empathy for that definitely makes me aware of my privilege. I'm also hearing, though, I'm realizing that privilege is relative, you know, completely to what might be around me or where I go and what somebody else, you know, I may have and someone else has whatever more. I definitely, the more I either, you know, put things in front of myself to understand other people's struggles and then decide because of that, and I do feel privileged and very grateful for what I've, the resources that I've been not only given in life, but are just right there for me. You know, I do not have to go far to work for them very much because of where I am. That then I decide as a human being, where in the world can I give something back to maybe make other people more privileged or whatever, however I might interpret that.
You're listening to Community and Unity, Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series. The event was recorded on January 19th, 2017 in Anchorage and focused on power and privilege in our society and how we can change those dynamics.
So being a non-white female, you would think that I would feel or be made to feel that I am not privileged. But I was born into a well-educated professional family, financially stable and fairly well off, and I've been privileged my entire life. I'm a professional, single female, and I've raised my two children who are non-white and in Anchorage, which has been really good about racial integration, or not, diversity, and, you know, we have the highest diversity schools in all of the nation. So, of course, my children went to South High School, which is probably the whitest high school in the nation, too. But they're, you know, one's graduated from college, another is still in college, and they're experiencing probably a very privileged life. However, things happen to me where I experience the stereotypes that people put you in. For example, when I bought my house and I was remodeling, and my contractor said, hey, go to this glass company because they provide really good service. And I walk in with my young children, non-white, without a male with me, and they don't provide me any service. And a white couple walks in after me and immediately get service. Or, you know, I would be standing at the meat counter at a grocery store and tall white male behind me gets service. So that kind of stuff happens all the time. And I kind of just ignore that. But in my practical life, coming from that well-educated, professional, financially secure background, and having no foreign accent, even if you don't look white, really helps and provides a lot of privilege.
Why do you ignore the instances when it's clear you're being discriminated against?
Actually, I didn't ignore that glass company incident and talk to their manager. But, you know, if it's a meat counter and the kid behind the counter doesn't see me because I'm short, it's fine. It's not something to stress over.
There was some mumblings of assent when she said something about not having an accent and what a difference that makes. Does anyone want to jump in on that point?
My name's January, and I'm from Cake, Alaska, which is a village, and I was basically born and raised there. And I'm Alaska Native, and I have the privilege of being able to speak basically without a standard Native accent. And a lot of stories resonated with me, but when I went down south to go to school, it was really great to not have to worry about being Native. I think actually where I experienced the most racism is here in Anchorage, even being in Portland and even being in Indiana for a number of years. But the flip side of that is that like I wasn't seen as Native or somebody of a different culture or diverse in any way. I tried to join the like multicultural club at my college, and they were like, but you're white, you can't join. Like literally, like verbatim, you can't join. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm not gonna do that. But it's very freeing. It's kind of nice to like not have to, you don't realize how much of a burden or what you're trying to carry or how you're trying to present yourself. And you can just like, and that, to me, that's privilege. I was like, wow, that's very free and liberating. And you can be based on like, well, I probably said something stupid, so that's why that person doesn't like me, rather than when I was 12 years old carrying my cousin around on the ferry and somebody was like, oh, is that your child? And I was like, I kind of looked old for a 12-year-old, but like not that old. That assumption, because I was Native, I had a kid at 12. So there's just a lot of different things. Like I can be well-spoken. Right now I'm like talking in a group, but not as well-spoken. But I guess, what do they call that? Like code switching, to like constantly have to think about, okay, I'm in this kind of group of people. It's just kind of when I didn't have to think about it, when I was down in the lower 48 where no one saw me as different, it was great. It was just freeing. And I was like, is this what it feels like to not have to worry about how someone's going to judge me based on whether or not they think I'm Native or a female? Or
well, the first thing that came to mind was the accent. It's like anything else, it makes that person different from me. So it's just, it's a simple difference, and as you say, not my tribe. And I think it's, you know, for me, it's pretty easy to get around that and wonder what's the content of the culture from which they've come. But then when I was listening to you talk about your experiences, it brought to mind a book I read years ago called You Just Don't Understand, and it's a linguistic anthropologist posited that communication between men and women is actually cross-cultural communication because they are socialized so differently in general. I found it a useful glossary because all my life I have worked in male-dominated environments, first in construction and now in engineering. And I learned what she had studied, the big difference between when men and women talk, why they talk, how they talk, with whom they talk, and how talking plays much different roles in interactions in the world. And so I realized that I was going to have to learn to speak man, and not speak like a man and lower my voice and and pound the table, but I would have to speak in a way that men understood that I existed and just not be the good listener that women often are. And so I would just make it a point to ask for more money, speak up in a meeting, say something, just so I would. But anyway, to take those awarenesses of the roles that communication plays, and I'm sure I speak man with a very bad accent, but once I took that on, I realized that I could be a bridge, and I could talk in a way that encouraged men to hear me. That's all.
So I feel like you're speaking about ways that we can adapt to overcome a lack of privilege. Are there other things that people do to adapt to this system, and should we be?
I think in my case, the main one where I have to adapt is actually when I'm in my own culture, because of the fact that you can have different levels of power and privilege even within a whole ethnicity. And there's a huge spectrum of difference of black culture there that we all have to adapt to each other. And one time I told my aunt, like, who made up all these rules of what black folk don't do? I didn't get that memo. And she's like, well, you're just like that the way you are, you know, with all this, like, you know, being gothic, having my earlobe stretched, these white things. And her explanation is, well, because you're half white. And I'm like, gothicism and earlobe stretching and veganism are like genetically inherited? Like, I didn't get that memo either in science class. And I do have more privilege from my lighter skin. I've experienced it. I've even been with one of my black friends who's as black as the night is long over in Mountain View, when I was an undergrad and we're walking down the street, popos come, stop us on the street, and, you know, the popos separate us, and I'm like, what do you want, officer? My hands are in the air, and I'm complying, and I've given you my ID, and I'm speaking slowly and carefully and not making sudden moves. Oh, you don't have to do that. The police officer assumed I was a white woman, and I'm like, no, we're both black, and you just saw their heads go, because they're like asking me, are you safe with this man? Do you know this man? He's been walking with you this whole time? You two actually know each other? We go to the same college class. It's like, and in that moment, it's like, he's being oppressed. I have privilege. Then it's like, you watch these two law enforcement officers have to adapt to the fact their paradigm wasn't what they perceived it to be. And finally, it's like, well, we obviously went on our way and nobody got the boots put to them. But we talked about it later, that in that moment, the fact that I was of a lighter complexion actually gave me more credibility and ethos than my friend, who was a dark-skinned black male.
Once again, nodding and understanding. None of you are surprised by any of this. Do you think people in our community still are?
People who are here because we're all interested in these issues, and I suspect that many of us have worked with these issues in varying capacities and or experienced these issues in varying capacities. I mean, I could identify a number of people here who have, and I think that some of us are more familiar with the issues because we allow ourselves to be more vulnerable and learn about other people. And that's, to me, one of the biggest hurdles that we all have to overcome is including people in conversations, asking them what they think, and not being afraid to hear what they think, and not feeling that it's somehow going to diminish us or diminish our standing, or make us more vulnerable in the world. I think that's why somebody mentioned tribalism. I mean, that's what this is all about. Every community and every group somehow oppresses someone within that group or someone else. There are assumptions about, I mean, we have all seen assumptions about accents. Someone who doesn't speak English well, and people assume that person is less educated and less intelligent than someone who speaks English well, which isn't true at all. But you have to be open to that idea and understand. You have to know people and be open to other people who aren't exactly like you in order to expand your world. So the question is, how do we do that? How do we expand our worlds and expand the worlds of our children? You know, I think President Obama said the other day that we're not in a post-racial America, obviously, but we've raised a generation of millennials who no longer see gender identity as a black and white issue. It's not a two-part issue. It's now a continuum. So if we've done that, how do we take it to the next issue?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. And I'm just thinking, like, I feel like I'm realizing a lot as we talk, which is always a great feeling. But like Anne, you were talking about earlier, like, should people be adapting? I forget what the specific example was, but let me talk like a man, like that's going to help me. I think there's like lots of different examples like that. And while I think that adaptation can be helpful in the immediate circumstance, which is unfortunate, but it can be helpful, I don't necessarily think it's going to help. And so I think in my brain, when I'm thinking all this right now, I'm thinking, well, what is going to help? And as a white, privileged young woman, I'm thinking, I mean, I know many of us here, I know several different AmeriCorps members in here, and I'm an AmeriCorps member myself, and I'm just finishing my year. And for those of you who don't know what AmeriCorps is, it's pretty much like, there's lots of different AmeriCorps around the United States who dedicate one full year to community service, and you're living at the poverty line of the city that you're living and serving with. And so I'm just finishing up my year right now, and I'm thinking, wow, I intentionally put myself in this circumstance. I moved to a completely different state that I've never been to. I didn't know anyone there. And I'm committing to living at the poverty line, and still I don't feel like my privilege has been taken away from me. Like, I still feel like I'm thriving in this community. I still have people who I rely on. My car broke down about 2 months ago, and I still have not had to use the bus one time. Like, just that speaks to my privilege. And it sucks. It sucks so bad, because even after, like, putting myself in a very intentional, like, just poverty alone, I still don't feel like I'm living in poverty, because I work with a lot of people who are living at that line, and I still don't feel like that, and I think I don't feel like I'm living at that same experience of poverty that they are. And I think that is because of the way I look. It has to be. I didn't have relationships here when I first moved here. And so, yeah, while I did have different interactions with people and obviously built those relationships and whatever, I just think that speaks a lot to the privilege that I have, even just starting over a new life and trying to be intentional about bringing down my privilege. And it kind of feels hopeless, which is really sad.
When I'm thinking about, yes, we're a circle and a room full of concerned individuals, and not everybody is, you know. I mean, a lot of people, they have their own pleasures and their own concerns, and this isn't one of them. I talked about not just being the good listener when I'm trying to engage, you know, my male counterparts in the workplace, but I do feel that listening and just accepting the totality of whatever that person's experience is a huge part of the answer, and not trying to convince them of anything, not trying to demonstrate anything for them, but just to experience that person. It only goes so far. To your point about adaptation, one of the things that's resulted is that men in the workplace come to me and spill their guts in ways that they don't with other men. And they would do that anyway, whether I spoke man or not. But they also come to me and ask how to talk with other female employees. And so I like to think of myself as a translator between the two worlds. It works for me, but also it helps introduce women's sensibilities in a way that men can hear. And so it does become kind of a two-way exchange.
I feel like we're at the portion of the wrapping up of this conversation where we can talk about solutions. We understand that there's different systems of privilege within our society, within our community. How do we make that system more equitable, if possible? We've heard adaptation, we've heard sharing experiences. Are there other ideas? And ooh, hands pop up all over the place. We'll go this direction.
I'm sure that this will just be a stream of consciousness, but I appreciate how we all are so determined to listen and be open and to call ourselves progressive. But it isn't changing the situation. I come from a privileged upper middle class family. I have family members. I was a public educator in Colorado and then Anchorage, and I've watched a lot of my people who claim to be progressive, who have the opportunity to put their children in an optional school or in a charter school, but they're all about, you know, social equity and social justice, and yet the actions do not align with that claim to be progressive. And you can see I get very animated about this, because I think that there are plenty of us, myself included, that make choices to continue to advance our station. You know, a bigger house, an extra cabin, a nicer car, a vacation that I don't really need to take. I mean, right now, my husband and I are struggling with a sabbatical he has where we could go gallivanting off on our bicycles to some wonderful place and just escape this madness for about 6 weeks. Or we're really wrestling with whether we should go to Lesvos, Greece, and do what we can for the Syrian refugees. And this is high stakes, real sacrifice that we are confronting, that we've never ever confronted. And I just put it out to everybody here who claims to come from privilege. What are you doing to make a real sacrifice and to walk your walk? Because it's easy to call yourselves, myself, a progressive, but I really think that our actions don't align with who we say we are.
So this whole time I've been racking my brain on like what the root of the problem is, and like how do you change something that's so deep-seated in some people? Like, obviously our minds are not the ones that need to be changed. But there's so many communities of people that have just banded together and refuse any outside influence whatsoever. Anything you say is just written off as crazy talk. I don't have to worry about that. It's nothing that I need to deal with. And that's the question, is how do you break into that and change those people's minds? Because those people are raising new people just like them. And it's kind of a problem that's perpetuating itself. And when it comes to this new generation, this millennial generation, we really are the ones that are going to change the world because we are progressive as a group. I'm an old millennial, 1984, like the first millennial year. So as a group of millennials, we have, you know, we've like spawned this whole gender identity thing and equal rights, and we're bringing up all these issues. So it's kind of like, it's the older generations, I think, that are holding on to a lot of these preconceived notions because that's what they've grown up in. That's what they've recognized as normal. That's just how the world worked when they were a kid, you know, put their hand on their hip. That's just how things work. So it's how do you penetrate those generations that are raising these children with their ideals? And it's like you can only have so many people turn into your station, Alaska Public Media, and say, I'm going to listen to this forum. Like, how do you spread that word when people just really aren't that open and receptive to the idea?
Just to play on that, I think access is a huge part of the problem. If you've got people who just don't have access to other types of people, they don't even know what they don't know. And so I personally have become like much more aware. Like I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I thought was very diverse, and like I don't even know a lot of stuff. And I've really taken like a personal commitment to speak when I see or hear, because silence is violence. And I think that's a personal commitment that we can all make because we're the ones in the privileged positions, and to use that privilege for something good.
So I'm from like a really small town in Michigan, and for me, like, I think a lot of the people that we are talking about as being unable to have access, those are people that I grew up with. And it's difficult, I think, because there is some privilege to being able to be in an educated space and to talk to people that have seen different things and have encountered different people. And I think in many ways for me, the people at home are different. And for me, I'm taking a bigger commitment to understand that side and to be able to listen more. Because even though I disagree, I think like that's a way that I need to start breaking in and speaking that language is, even recently, like someone from like my parish life that like was important to me, she posted an article about homophobia, and it just like bothered me for days. Like she said, you know, like she completely agreed with the article and that like people that are gay are just wrong and sick, and that bothered me for days. But for me to be like, you're wrong and sick, that would have been the wrong language. That wasn't speaking her language. Her language is compassion, and her language is like God's love. And if I can speak from a place of like of words that she can understand and that like personally resonate for her, like maybe that's also seeing people that are different too, even though that's hard. And I think for me, like, I spend a lot of time saying, like, I'm privileged, but I work in social services, so it's good enough. I'm privileged, but I educate myself and come to these meetings, and that's good enough. And I'm really trying to catch myself saying I'm privileged, but, and trying to catch community members doing that too, or my parents who think, you know, they're privileged, but, you know, they're good people. Like, I don't know if that's quite enough.
Just to build off of what you said, I think, you know, silence is violence, and not just in outright situations of oppression or injustice that you're seeing, but even confronting microaggressions on a day-to-day basis in your workplace, in conversations with people. I think just even confronting those small things that are really perpetuating this system of oppression and privilege are really important. And yeah, I just think that is, even that in itself is a really important step to take. And, you know, not just applauding diversity from afar and saying, oh, well, we have this really great diverse neighborhood in Anchorage, it's awesome. Like, actually go eat at a restaurant in Mountain View, go ride the People Mover, and don't put your headphones in and talk to somebody on the bus. You know, I think putting yourself in situations, not just from afar, but actually stepping in and participating in those spaces is really important.
I think it's important that we live our progressive values. If we have them and we speak them, we need to model them. And as a public educator, that was one of the lessons that I took away from the classroom, was that it was very important that whatever you wanted from your tribe, you went ahead and modeled that for them. There's a study that was done where this troop of baboons lost a bunch of its male members at one point because of an infection that happened to them, and the females took over leadership of that tribe. And whenever new male baboons came to join that group, they were socialized by those females, and that new culture endured. And I think that's an example that we as tribal creatures can carry.
We have just a few moments left.
If people really want to try, whenever something comes up before your school board or the assembly or whatever, if they ask themselves, would I approve of this for my family? Is this good enough? And that could be a phrase. Is this good enough for our community? Is it good enough for me? And I think that just putting ourselves out there and saying we can make the difference. Warren Buffett, a couple of years ago, said, we either do or do not have the luck of the womb. Now think about that one, the luck of the womb. And I don't want to see the so-called white burden. People talked about that some years ago. I'm thinking, what is that? You got too much money? I mean, you know, I had the chance to go live in Samoa for 4 years, many years ago, and I just jumped right into it, I wove a sleeping mat and, you know, all this kind of stuff, because it was a chance to get to know people who were completely unknown to me. You know, dare to be different. And I'm talking to the choir here, I realize that. But at the same time, it has to start somewhere. So if we go speak out at the school board and say, what you're proposing may be saving us some money, but what's it costing us in the long run? The opportunity costs, because we're not caring for all of our children. You know, what's going to happen? Are we going to have to fill the prisons, warehouse humans as we're doing now? Is that going to be good enough for us? Good enough for our culture? Good enough for our future? I think those answers would be jumping right out at us.
This may sound idealistic, but education still, I think, is the greatest equalizer. And I was happy to hear on the radio, on KSKA earlier today, that education is the largest portion of our state budget. So I don't know how many other states can boast that. And I would hope that the legislature would really look at education funding and provide equal education, equal access education to all of our children all over the state.
This has been Community and Unity, a community conversation with Alaska Public Media. Thank you all for joining us.
That was Community and Unity, Power and Privilege. It's part of Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series and was recorded with a live studio audience in Anchorage on January 19th, 2017. To hear more episodes, visit alaskapublic.org and look for Community and Unity under the Programs tab. Thanks for listening.